Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, my regularly occurring interview series where I sit down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry. Today, I am joined by two gentlemen, Peter Tamty and Jamie Griesmer. Now, if you don't know them by name, you know what they've worked on, and that is Halo 1, which is what's behind me, including a number of other Halo games in the Bungie years as well. But now, the thing they're here to talk about today is the re-announcement of a game called 6 Days in Fallujah, which is a tactical first-person shooter. And there is a lot to talk about with this game. This kind of won't be the normal where did everybody's career come from IGN Unfiltered. I really do want to dedicate a lot of time to talking about this game and the reasons for making it and the story behind it. So, Peter, I want to start with you first on this. First of all, where have you been for a while? Because, you know, this game came up in 2009. It was announced. We'll talk about that more in a minute. But I feel like I have not heard from you in a while. So what have you been in the game space for the last number of years? What have you been up to?
No, I left the game space. And, you know, what happened to us in 6 Days in Fallujah was pretty disheartening back in 2009. And so, yeah, I actually left the games industry for about four or five years. But throughout that time, I knew I was going to at some point come back and try to do something with 6 Days in Fallujah. So I went and made productivity software.
Anything we'd know?
NoteSuite is there's a bunch of productivity. Yeah. NoteSuite was one of them, Project Book and a few other ones. They did really well. And so I enjoyed my little vacation from the games industry. So but it's good to be back now.
Do you feel like did you just need a break from games in particular after the original round of 6 Days, or did you just kind of want a change of pace and to try a new challenge?
It's a mixture of both. I was pretty disheartened by the way people received 6 Days in Fallujah within the game's media. And so at that point, I felt like I needed to take a little bit of a breakout. It wasn't everybody. I mean, there was an awful lot of support within the industry as well. It was a little bit of a mixture of both, but it was hard to break through that barrier of trying to do something serious about a very serious subject that I think really stopped some people from looking more deeply into what we could actually do with a video game.
Yeah. So you've already hinted at it here that I imagine. So it was 2009. For those that aren't familiar with the story, 2009, Konami announces with Peter's studio, Atomic Games at the time, announces 6 Days in Fallujah, a game based on the second battle in Fallujah from the Iraq War in 2004, if I remember that correctly. And I was at the games press event, Peter, where Konami announced this. So, you know, show the trailer, they talk about it. And then I've never seen this in my 18 plus years in the games industry. I hadn't seen it before and I haven't seen it since. I believe it was roughly 2 weeks later. It was an inordinately short amount of time later, the game was canceled. So I have to imagine that result was very much a surprise to you.
I was shocked. Yeah, actually, I got the news when I was on a rental car bus. And one of the guys from Konami called me and said, you know, I got bad news for you, Peter. Are you somewhere where we can talk? And I said, well, no, not really. He said, well, actually, I got to talk anyways. And so we actually, he described the situation that it was Konami's parent company, mm-hmm. effectively, that was ordering the U.S. unit to pull out of the project.
Interesting. So you had obviously no say in the matter. You were just told this while you're on an airport shuttle.
That's exactly true. Yes. Yeah, that's right. And not due to his... understand, the Konami US people were very supportive throughout the entire project. They were completely behind it, and they were very upset. In fact, many Konami staff actually walked out of the office in protest that day And the problem that they had was it was going to go over the news wires in the Tokyo newspapers. And so he's like, I got to tell you now. So he did.
So, I mean, I'm sure you've asked yourself, if not ask Konami this, I mean, I don't know if they just kind of cut off communication with you entirely or what, but don't they consider any reactions to this before they announced the game? Like, it almost sounds like there really wasn't a lot of vetting or, you know, I'm kind of curious what, you know, what you were able to learn from them or what they did tell you about, because it's just, I mean, it's not a good look for you, but it's not a good look for them to announce a game and then just kill it a couple weeks later.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in terms of what did we learn from them? I think I think there was a disconnect between the U.S. unit and the Japanese headquarters. And there was no point in which the U.S. unit thought that they should pull out of the project.
Right.
So what the kind of conversations that happened behind the scenes between the U.S. unit and the Japanese unit, I don't know. I don't know. But the U.S. unit was always very good to us.
I think we've learned that this game is very complicated, and it can be difficult to communicate to people what it's about and why it exists. And I think if you're not familiar with the project, just even imagining it, like you're not gonna actually imagine what the game is intended to be. And so I think there was it's just a difficult to get over that first hump.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think certainly if you ask us something I've learned, what I've learned is that the people who are inside the projects, they have always been super supportive. The people who really know what we're trying to do, been super supportive. I mean, we got 85 people working at Atomic on 6 days in Fallujah. And even after Konami pulled out, not a single one of them resigned. Mm-hmm. Not a single one of them. They held with us. And the team now has been very supportive of what we're doing. And I think that a lot of it has to do with understanding what it is we're actually trying to do with the game.
So what's that? I mean, I'm sorry to kind of pick at a scab here, but this is just such an unprecedented kind of story in the games business, as far as I know. So then it falls to you then, I presume, to have to go back and tell those 85 people that are working on the game that it's over.
Yeah. I mean, we had conversations with other publishers back then, too. The challenge back then was that there was a very limited number of publishers that could fund that size of a budget.
Right.
And so most of them already had a military shooter at the time, or they were also afraid of the same thing happening to them that happened to Konami at the time.
Right.
So we had CEO level discussions with a number of very large publishers immediately after that, and there was some very serious conversations with a number of them. But in the end, it was one of those two problems that stopped it from happening.
Yeah. Well, Jamie, I want to ask you in a minute here about how Highwire came to get involved in this all these years later. But Peter, first, I'm just curious. You know, this game. I would never have guessed in a million years that this game would come back. That any game that's been gone for this long that never came out is now back in development, back in the works. So, what is it about this project that means so much to you that you've fought to keep it alive? Is it personal for you in some way?
Yeah, I mean these Marines and Iraqis trusted us with their moments of truth. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. And I found in those stories, these situations that really expose things that divide us as well as things that can bring us together. And it has always been my hope that if I can just expose players to those same stories, that they will see those same things that divide us and the same things that bring us together. And in the end, there's some hope in that. I mean, when we think, what can a video game do that other media can't, it really has a lot to do with allowing people to actually participate in somebody else's story. Not to watch somebody else's story, but to participate in that story. And there's an empathy that comes through in that, that you can't get by watching somebody on a TV screen, right? So from the very beginning, Marines, soldiers, Iraqis, people in the industry who've been closely exposed to the game, everybody, once they see that, they seem to understand. Now, the challenge for us has been that there are certainly people who look at the project from the outside and worry whether or not we're going to just whitewash history. And so it's up to us now to do some things to show that that's not our intent, that our intent is actually to deal with all the serious subjects that are inherent in such a complex situation.
Nobody that has watched the video and the interviews and these testimonials has been unchanged by them. I mean, they're very, very powerful. And so I think that's what keeps bringing this back to the surface, is that you just can't forget them. You can't move on from them because they need to be told.
Now, you know, even though it's been over 10 years since this game was originally announced, I mean, I've already seen in the reactions to the re-announcement, a lot of people continue to feel very, very strongly about this all these years later. Now, your reveal trailer, if people haven't seen it, maybe we're watching it now, depending on how this video gets edited. But the reveal trailer for 2021 does seem to convey to me that you guys really are taking this very seriously. And you know, in the trailer, you're featuring a number of the soldiers and civilians who were really there. So kind of what is the message to the people that are concerned about making a game about this? And I guess that the follow up I would ask there, too, would be, you know, you mentioned earlier, Peter, about kind of needing to convey the, you know, show it to people the right way. And when people see it, they get it. You know, do you feel like thus far here in the initial wave, you know, you've done some press already. Do you feel like you've done a good job of reintroducing this, or is there now, you know, do you feel like the people still need to see more?
For sure, people need to see more. You know, that we made a tough decision based on something we learned last time. So when we announced 6 Days in Fallujah in 2009, we had spent the 3 years before that building a game engine that allows us to completely destroy the entire game world. So this is 6 years before Rainbow Six Siege lets you blow holes in the wall. Right. We had a game in which you could destroy the whole battlefield brick by brick. Nobody talked about it. Nobody talked about it. And I mean, the people who were there at the Konami event saw that, but no stories after that were written about that. Yeah. They were all written about the controversy. And in the end, I don't think that the controversy is necessarily what players are interested in, right? They're interested in what is the actual game like. And so this time around, we knew if we announced it again that there were going to be people who were going to say it was a bad idea. So we thought, let's have that conversation first before we try to actually describe the game itself. But then I think once people start to see what we're doing in the game, then I believe that they'll understand more about why it is that's important for us to make this game and how it's different than other military shooters.
So in the press release for, you know, just now re-announcing the game, it says the game gives these stories voice through gameplay and first person accounts captured in original documentary interview footage. So does that mean that you guys have integrated that real life documentary footage into the game, which is similar to what Respawn just did this past holiday with Medal of Honor Above and Beyond? Is that, am I interpreting that correctly?
That is correct. Yeah. I mean, there is an integration of the two, but go ahead, Jamie. Yeah. You're anxious to say something.
Yeah. Right? Sorry. I think one of the reasons why people are reacting so strongly is because when you imagine what this game could be, you imagine, okay, well, you know, it's like a military shooter campaign, and it's got characters that are made up and situations that are written by a team of writers. But it's, you know, it's based on all this, like they did a lot of research, right? That's not what this game is at all. We are taking these testimonials. In fact, the code name for the game was Testimony for a long time. Mm. We're taking these testimonials And we are trying to present them as a documentary would. And then where a documentary might go to a reenactment or B-roll or stock footage, we're then allowing the gameplay to take over, right? And put you in the same similar situations and try to mirror this person's story through the gameplay. And then we go back, we dip back into the video, back into the testimonial to hear, you know, some of the consequences of the event. Or now, you know, 10, 15 years later, looking back on it, how does this person think? Or what were the perspectives of some of the other people that were involved? So there isn't a campaign with a story and, you know, actors. There's none of that. This is a documentary with interactive sections in a lot of ways.
Interesting.
And I don't know how you communicate that in a 3-minute trailer.
Right.
I mean, we tried. Like, we absolutely put in clips from these testimonials, and we tried to not tell story in the game. But this is a new concept, right? This is not something that's been done before. And so it's just going to take a while, and it's going to take more content and more kind of talking about the actual features of the game for people to even really understand, you know, and allow them to make judgments about it.
So Jamie, that actually kind of brings me to a good point to ask this. So how, you know, with this, when obviously Peter's been connected to this for so long, you had been at Bungie, and then you co-founded Highwire, you did Golem. So how do you and Highwire come to get involved in this?
So in order to answer that question, I have to take you all the way back to 2006.
Please.
So we were working on Halo 3 at the time, and we were preparing a multiplayer beta, right? We had all these new features that we were excited to test and that went way beyond what Halo 2 had done. But we needed stress testing. We were going to release this wide public beta. And toward the end of 2006, some context that some of the executives at the studio had, we got the opportunity to do a USO trip to Iraq. So the plan was, we're going to take 32 Xboxes, we're going to take 32 TVs, 32 power supplies, we're going to crate them up, we're going to send some members of the development team to a small base outside of Ramadi. And even saying this, it sounds crazy. And basically set up a multiplayer lab for these deployed soldiers. And they were going to play the game before anybody else. And as soon as I heard that this trip was being planned, I cashed in all my chips. I said, look, I've never asked to go to Europe. You know, I never asked to, like, you know, tour with the South American marketing crew. I want to go. And, you know, at the time I was, you know, single and didn't have any kids, and I was kind of young, and it was something that I felt like I needed to do. Right. So they put us on a plane. We flew into Kuwait, and then the military took our passports and put us on a, you know, a C-130 and flew us really low into a, you know, one of the Air Force bases in Iraq. And talked about putting us on a convoy that was driving to this operating base that we were going to. We ended up taking a Black Hawk helicopter. This is, we could talk for an hour about this story, but the thing that sticks out for me is these guys would go be out on patrol. They would come in, they would come into the lab, they would prop their rifle up against the desk. They play Halo for 4 hours, and then they'd stand up, pick up the rifle, and go back out on patrol. And it was humbling for sure that video games were such an integral part of their experience, right? Like, these guys were not watching TV or reading comic books or any of the kind of other media that you would normally associate with deployment. These guys played video games a lot, and they played Halo specifically a lot. And they would, you know, they would talk about how important it was to have this outlet for them. The other thing that I noticed while watching these guys play, I mean, these guys are military trained, right? Like, they've got all of this cutting edge training. They're actually like actively deployed, and they're playing against our test team back in Seattle and getting destroyed. Like, the skills that they were using on the battlefield were not at all what you needed in order to play Halo well. And every 15 minutes, somebody would come up and say, "Hey, we really love playing Halo, but like, that's not what combat's like at all. That's nothing. I mean, obviously it's, you know, Space Marines and all that stuff, but they're like, yeah, video games are not like combat at all. It's, you know, it's not even the same. If you try to fight a war like you fight in Halo, you wouldn't last 10 minutes. And they would even talk about how it was a mental switch that they would flip when they would come and play Halo. So as you can imagine, that trip had a pretty profound impact on me.
Yeah.
And just how I thought about these soldiers that were deployed. And I was there for 2 weeks, right? And I wasn't really in danger the whole time. So you can only imagine how somebody who was on the front lines, how they would be impacted by their experience.
Puts things in perspective for you.
Absolutely. I mean, and it kind of, when I came back, my first day back, I was in a design meeting and we were talking about, well, how much damage should the plasma grenade do to a grunt when his friend is stuck with it, and what should be the radius? And I just remember sitting in that meeting going, I don't think I can work on another Halo game after this. Like, I just, Halo is amazing. It made my career. I thoroughly enjoyed all the time I spent on it. But I think I'm kind of done. You know, this can't be all that there is.
Yeah.
Right. This can't be all that video games can be. And so that was like, you know, experience number one.
So what did you think then, before we get to actually coming around to how Highwire got involved in this, when 6 days first comes around, when Peter's first got this, I'm sure, you know, maybe given that you guys worked together for a time, maybe you'd heard about it prior to Konami announcing the game. But so what was your reaction to it, when it originally came around?
I was excited for the service members involved, because even with my interactions in 2006, like, I heard the same thing that Peter did, was, hey, you know, when we come back, we don't want to watch a movie about what we did. We don't want to read a book about what we did. We want to play a video game about what we did. I mean, that's their media, right? And so I was excited for them. But I was also, and you know, it was a failure of imagination on my part. I was also skeptical. I mean, I think you have to be skeptical, right? Like,
yeah.
Can
what demands
video
that,
games...
right? This subject demands that.
Absolutely. And I have a lot of sympathy for people that are skeptical. I mean, the games industry has not done a good job at this. Not at all. Like, I think one of the other steps on my trip to wanting to work on this game was, I was watching, I don't know, some reveal for some giant military shooter, right? And there was a mission with an AC-130 gunship where, you know, you're basically circling a battlefield and taking out enemies from the air.
Yeah.
And I had seen the leaked video of the actual, you know, the actual mission, right? The real life version, and found it just very, very difficult to deal with, right? It was disconcerting, you know, just how calm everything was. Meanwhile, this destruction is getting rained down. But when I saw it in the video game, my first reaction as a game developer was, wow, how are they doing that? That's like so accurate. Like that looks exactly like the YouTube video that I saw. But my second reaction was, stripped of context, this is, it's meaningless, you know?
Yeah.
Like, stripped of the situation and the kind of human element, it's just a really amazing piece of technology. And you see this happening over and over again in the games industry where like there's a multiplayer map and it's set on the Euphrates, right? It's set in Fallujah. There's a trestle bridge that goes over the Euphrates that's extremely well known. If you're kind of paying attention to what's happening in world events. They made it into a multiplayer map. They totally stripped it of context, and it does a disservice, I think, to their topic. And you like, and that goes, it goes all the way down to like every single gun is like meticulously built, and it's like this weld is here and this screw is here, but they treat them like they're cars in a racing game,
right?
This is a tool of death. This has one purpose, right? But we're gonna like paint it electric pink and chrome, and I just, all that stuff the game industry has not handled the context around the action that they want to show very well.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons and Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out the Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find the Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
So then take me to what I imagine now is 2 or 3 years ago. Does Peter call you? How does Highwire, which is a relatively small studio, I've got to visit you a few years ago now, when you were starting on Golem, you know, yeah. yourself and in my opinion, the best video game composer on the planet, Marty O'Donnell. You've got one or two other ex-Bungie folks there. So how does Highwire come to be involved with Peter on the mm-hmm. revival of 6 Days?
Yeah, so we, you know, we kind of, you keep in touch with people around the industry, right? And I think Marty actually was the one who got an email from Pete saying, hey, I'm going to be at GDC. Are you guys going to be at GDC? We should meet up. And we did. It was actually right after we had pitched Golem. So we were, you know, pretty excited about that opportunity. And at that point, Pete was just asking for advice. He's like, look, I have these interviews. I have these stories that I've been asked to share with the world. How am I going to get this done? And I think, you know, we gave him some advice. We gave him some people maybe he wanted to contact. And then we said, good luck. We're going to go make Golem. We're going back to Seattle. And then maybe it was like a couple years after that, he reached back out and he said, okay, you know, now I've got this like playable experience and, you know, feel free to interrupt to correct the record, but, you know, I've raised some money and like, I think this could actually happen. What do you guys think about VR? And we played it and we're like, wow, you have something really powerful that you have to be careful. You know, you have to move carefully, to really do it justice. So good luck with that. So then the third time he came back to us and he was like, hey, I want you guys to work on this. Like, I think you guys are the right team. And again, through a failure of imagination, it was like, I don't really want to work on a shooter again. I especially don't want to try to take this tiny team and compete with some of the biggest, most well-funded teams on the planet, like right in their wheelhouse.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Even though you clearly had such a strong reaction to the other military shooters, I mean, I'm detecting, you know, kind of a, for lack of a better term, sort of almost like a, not a chip on your shoulder, but you know, you felt like that genre wasn't being properly served and you still were hesitant to take this on.
Well, yeah, because at the time, you know, I wasn't sure video games could properly address the context.
Right.
Right. Peter being wily, sent me a bunch of the videos. He said, okay, well, you know, just watch these videos. Maybe they'll inspire something. And so then I found myself watching these hours of not just service members, not just US, like Marines and soldiers that were there. But I mean, these interviews, it was with the police chief in Fallujah at the time. It was with the governor of the province. It was with, you know, people who own stores in Fallujah, right? Who, you know, were just trying to like make a living. And every few minutes, someone would say something that floored me, where I would just say, I had no idea that that happened. I had no idea that this was like that. Why isn't anybody like telling us that this particular thing went down? And I was engaged with the news. Like I, you know, was addicted to cable news like everybody else at the time.
Yeah.
It just was not, it was not being covered. And so I went back to Pete and I said, okay, if we're going to do this, it's not going to be Medal of Honor light, right? We're not going to be a budget version of Call of Duty and get this done.
Yeah.
We're going to make a documentary. We're going to make a video. I mean, there's been plenty of documentaries about video games, but there hasn't been a video game documentary.
Yeah.
Like we're not gonna try to tell a story, right? Like we're just gonna show these guys stories.
See, that's what I feel like you guys needed to say in the press release. Like that sums it up pretty well. Like I feel like that's something that is very intriguing. That's and in fact, to that end, Jamie, I promise Peter, poor Peter's being kept on ice over there. But okay. this is great stuff from Jamie. Is Jamie, you're kind of most famous to the game playing public, at least, of being the 30 seconds of fun guy from Bungie. You're the guy that sort of developed that.
I think most people know me like that. I think most people know that quote because of you. I think you're the one who's really like, kind of giving me that moniker. Whatever. I 30 seconds of fun was, that was what Halo was.
Yeah.
Right. Like, the sort of the meaning of 30 seconds of fun was you set up these mechanics in such a way that the actions that you have available to you are constantly changing, and the situations that you're getting thrown into are constantly changing, but there's still this repeated loop of you know, melee and primary weapon and grenades that are, you know, it's just keeping you in the flow, right? It repeats roughly every 30 seconds.
And well, the reason I bring it up is because in the context of 6 days in Fallujah, I want to ask you, you know, does that design adage apply here? Can it apply here? I mean, with something that is this serious, that is attempting to be a playable documentary, what is the fun, or is it fun as far as like the gameplay goes? Because it's not meant to make you hoot and holler and go, yeah, you know, so what are the design? So all of that, and then the postscript to this question is, what are the design challenges of a project like this from a gameplay perspective?
Yeah, I mean, so this is sort of another reason why this project is so interesting to me, because it's a challenge. Can we take the same principles, right, of like setting up mechanics and structures inside of a game to create an experience inside the player's mind? Can we use those same tools? But our goal is not fun, right? Our goal is empathy. Our goal is, to give you just a little taste of what something must be like. So then when you hear the person explain in their own words what it was like for them, you have that connection point, right?
Yeah.
So all of the mechanics in the game are based on these testimonials. I think a really good example of that is the procedural architecture. This is a whole system that we developed for the game.
Yeah.
So we heard over and over from these guys, you never knew what to expect anytime you went in a house, anytime you opened a door. Like, you could not anticipate what was going to happen on the other side. And in a traditional video game, that applies to the first time you play. Right, you're playing through a campaign mission. You kick open the door. Oh, it's an ambush. There's a guy over there. There's a guy over there. And maybe you don't succeed. Maybe they get you. Right. You revert back to a checkpoint. You come back to the same door. You already have a beat on the first guy before you even open the door.
Right.
That is not the experience that these guys had. Right. Like, they got one shot. And how are we going to recreate that game? So we spent, I mean, literally months and bordering on years developing this technology that allows us to recreate entire sections of the city dynamically. Mm-hmm. So not only do you not know what's going to happen when you kick open the door, me as a designer, I don't know, right? I didn't go in and place all the little nodes and set up the scripting and all this stuff. it's generated.
Yeah.
Right?
Kind of like then, Diablo, right? Where they procedurally generate their dungeons.
Absolutely. And that keeps it fresh, right? It keeps you on your toes. But I think most importantly is, like, if you fail and you're going to try again, we regenerate, right? So there, you never have any foreknowledge.
Right.
And there's gameplay reasons for that. There's game design kind of like considerations where that's a desirable outcome. The real reason for doing it is so that you get just a little bit of what it must have been like. Obviously, we cannot incorporate the whole entire experience. We can't even come close, right? But we can give you just a tiny little bit. So then when you go back into the testimonial and the Marine says, I was afraid every time I opened a door, you understand why. You have a little connection that allows you a lot greater understanding of what this must have been like.
So get with regard to the feel that you're kind of talking about, sort of trying to convey that emotion, is Marty scoring this? Marty O'Donnell, is there a sort of soundtrack to this, or is the soundtrack a lack of sound and that being kind of emotional unto itself? What's
absolutely Marty's writing music for the game.
And so what is he thinking? What's the tone of that? Like, I mean, with Marty, as brilliant as I think he is, his resume is largely sort of almost fantasy-ish in this, at this, Golem, Destiny, Halo, they're very sort of, sci-fi. So what's the tone that the score is going for here?
I think one thing that's great about Marty is that he will surprise you. You know, he's made Halo games that with a jazz-based soundtrack.
True.
Right? And I remember when he first played us the Halo 3 announcement trailer, and it's just the piano, right? Like, everything about the score has always been huge and dramatic, and then nope, this time just the piano, and it gives you chills. And so I never try to predict what Marty's going to do. But I can tell you that Marty is not just a composer, he's an audio director. And what he sees as the challenge is not how do you score this game. It's how do you sound design this game?
Yeah.
You know, like we ask these guys, like, hey, what kind of like hand signals are you using in combat? And like, what kind of code lingo words are you using? Right. And they're like, no, we don't, right? Gunfire is so deafening. Here's what we say. We say ceasefire a lot because it's so loud on the battlefield, you cannot communicate to the guy standing right next to you if he's firing his weapon.
Yeah.
And so, how do we recreate that in the sound design? How do we use dynamic range in the audio to recreate that complication that these guys had in our interactive experience.
I'd be curious to hear that, to actually hear that with a good pair of headphones on and see what you guys have come up with for that. Now, Peter, obviously the new game, I would imagine, doesn't share anything with the 2009 version on the technical side. Does it share anything with the original vision of the game design-wise, or in some other way, aside from the story itself?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd say two elements, essentially, that are still shared. One is the true stories, for sure. I mean, we knew back then that we really wanted to let players experience these stories through video as well, so that they can get to know these people as human beings. I mean, this is part of the challenge of most video games, right? Is it's an avatar on a screen, you kind of feel like it's fake. But if we can just get these real people in front of you, you're going to understand this is a real human being story, right? So that's one element that Jamie used as a foundation, but has enhanced it in some really unique ways that we're going to start talking about a little bit later, because there's a lot of ways that we can integrate that communication during the game. And the second thing is we always knew this wanted to be a tactical shooter mm-hmm. and not a run and gun shooter, right? So the tone wouldn't be right. But more importantly than that, one thing that has been very consistently communicated to us by these Marines is today's games are just so different than actual combat that because you can solve problems by yourself, right? You can run through a map and play like Rambo and still succeed.
Right.
That just won't work. And so in real combat, it's about tactics. And it's about making sure that you are coordinating your activities with others on your team, because that's the only way to overwhelm that enemy is to get, a higher volume of fire or be able to fix somebody in place with suppressive fire while another element flanks that person. So that is the essence of what real combat is really like. And it's not something that I have experienced in a lot of games since Full Spectrum Warrior and Brothers in Arms, right? So it's been a long time since I've actually really gotten that. But what is really unique, however, is that Jamie has figured out some ways to make that actually work in a much more compelling way. So one of the reasons so many of these tackle shooters that try to tackle this idea of a full team assaulting an insurgent is, that you get, there's an obscurity. There's too many layers of abstraction between the player and the action, because you've got radial menus, or if you've got button combos, you've got all sorts of things that don't make as instantaneous as you need to be. And so people don't do it, right? And number two is you don't need to do it. That the enemy has been created in such a way in most games that you can't beat that enemy by yourself. So the challenge that Jamie and the team at Highway have really zeroed in on is, how do you fix those two problems, right? How do you create enemies that are actually using tactics that require a coordinated team to overwhelm them? And number two, how do we make it as easy for you to order your team to do something as it is to fire your weapon? Fundamentally, if we can make it as easy to direct your team as it is to fire your weapon, then that becomes as powerful of a tool for the player as the weapon. So that's where we get the go command. And that's Jamie's, that's some brilliant thinking on how to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it comes back to the interview. Right, like we again, I told you, we asked these guys what kind of hand signals they use, and we said, well, we pointed a lot, and if we pointed at this, it meant go there, and if we pointed at this, it meant like suppress for me, and if we pointed at this, it meant we're going this way. And so trying to recreate that kind of contextual communication is how we arrived at the go command system.
And in case, I've seen the gameplay video you guys either, by the time this video airs, have put out or about to put out. Can you explain that a bit more, Jamie?
Sure. So, my background is console, right, where buttons are at a premium. And a lot of times you'll design a game for a keyboard, and then when you try to cram it on a console, you end up having to do all kinds of crazy UI things. And so from the beginning, I'm like, look, teamwork is very important. Communicating to your fire team what they need to do is going to be a crucial aspect of the game. But this, you can't be babysitting them. Like, these guys have to behave autonomously. They have to have good AI. I mean, essentially, when you're playing in a single player setting.
Yeah.
So we're just going to narrow it down to, you basically have one thing that you can do, which is you can point and you can say go, right? And if you're pointing at a door when you say go, it means stack up on that door because we're going through it. And if you're pointing at a corner, it means secure that corner, watch that corner, because I'm going to go this way. But I need somebody watching. It's a 360 battlefield. I need somebody watching that way. And by kind of like bringing stuff down to just the contextual communication, you can't do elaborate three-part plans with your AI, but it's very responsive. Like, it's happening constantly as you're going through a house, you're able to just manage your team as you're also trying to focus on a bunch of other things. And then that extends to the co-op experience too, right? Like if we're playing together, I don't have to just describe an elaborate plan. I can just give you the appropriate go command, and you see it on your screen. You're like, okay, I understand what we're doing here.
Right. Peter, I'm glad you brought up Full Spectrum Warrior because as soon as I saw your gameplay video, that was the first thing that popped to mind. I reviewed that game back in the day when it first came out, and it got a sequel, which I played as well. That game, of course, as you are well aware, was designed first and foremost as a training tool for the U.S. Army before it was converted into a full and proper video game by the now defunct Pandemic Studios. But one thing I think that really came through with Full Spectrum Warrior was that, at least in my opinion, it really did a good job of treating U.S. Army soldiers with a lot of respect and reverence, and it took its subject matter very, very seriously. So have you spent a lot of time either recently or just over the years playing Full Spectrum Warrior? Is that game, or is there any other game or games? Are those a touchstone for what you're trying to do here with 6 Days in Fallujah?
Yeah, definitely. So I think there's, the two games that I would refer to the most actually is Brothers in Arms and Full Spectrum Warrior.
Yeah.
So in both of those games, there were benefits to working with your team, and you were allowed to use real military tactics like fire maneuver actually make a difference. Everything is based on fire maneuver in actual combat. So, and I thought both of those experiences were brilliant in their own ways. The questions that we've had is how do we make that concept a little bit more accessible so that more players might be able to participate and understand those two tactics and be able to actually execute those much quicker.
It's funny because my reference point is something more like Papers, Please, right? Hmm. Where there's such a clear line from the mechanics of the game to the experience that is created to the real world experience that's being referenced that you understand, like, it's in just this like direct line into your brain. Oh, like this is what, you know, manning a border could be like, right? And so I do think the depth of something like a Full Spectrum Warrior is how it tries to accurately capture tactics is important, because like if we're not creating mechanics that force you to use real world tactics, then we're not recreating their experiences, right? We're letting you just like be a super soldier in a real battlefield, which is not the intention at all.
Right. So, Peter, I'm curious. I mean, after watching the gameplay video, watching your trailer, just kind of I feel like I've got to ask, at least kind of get your thoughts on this. You know, this is, as you've seen, as we've talked about, and this is a subject, this battle, this war is something that is very upsetting to a lot of people. It's something that's still very raw to a lot of people. So, I mean, I'm kind of curious if you could speak to the question of why not kind of go the Full Spectrum Warrior route, not in the gameplay sense, but in the sense of real tactics, focus on realism, but just setting it as in a fictional story rather than something that so many people are genuinely connected to in their, you know, daily lives, either in the active their family members or the memories of people they've lost.
Well, it's because of the stories themselves. They, you know, we have always approached understanding about these events through the proxy of fiction in video games. And we couldn't, for example, at that point, put these real human beings on a screen in front of you and have you understand their story. If we did that through fiction, we would have to rewrite that somehow. And it's knowing that these things actually happened that I think give us information and empathy for not just the people, but an understanding of what has been dividing us culturally as well. And that can't, you could certainly dip your toes in that through fiction, but you can't really capture it. So, and there's a second point here, which is it has truthfully, it's really bothered me that here we have this battle that is one of the most significant battles in the Western world in nearly half a century. But Hollywood has been afraid to tell these stories. Just because the war in Iraq was controversial doesn't mean that it isn't filled with stories of sacrifice. And so shouldn't those people's stories be told? I mean, if you think about it from a Marine or soldier's perspective right now, and I'm just talking in this case about that side, mm-hmm. If somebody saved your life, you'd want the world to know about that. If somebody died saving your life, you'd want the world to know about that. And because the Iraq war has been so controversial, those stories have not been told. And I don't know how we, A, can recognize those sacrifices without telling those stories, the true stories, or B, learn from those sacrifices without telling those true stories.
And I would say, if you're making a full spectrum warrior or some kind of training simulation, you're not telling the full story, right? We've talked a lot about the Marines and the soldiers' tactics, their testimonials. That's only part of this project that we're working on. We've interviewed dozens of Iraqis, right? In fact, we were kind of like laying out, here's the events that we want to cover. Here's the parts of the battle that we want to cover. And we started seeing holes. It's like, it's easy for us to find somebody in Florida who was part of the Marines to interview, but there's this whole component that we don't have enough testimonials from Iraqis, to be frank. And so last year we have an embedded journalist on the team. He has done journalism in Texas, covered all kinds of sort of difficult, serious topics. We sent him to Fallujah to get more interviews from Iraqis that lived in Fallujah at this time. And those are going to be in the game. I mean, we'll get them translated into English, and that will provide, I think, a perspective that you would never get from something that was exclusively focusing on the Marines. And that's so important to us at Highwire. And I think that is maybe the most difficult thing about the reception so far is kind of our intentions in doing this. I've read dozens of books on this battle, watched every documentary out there, and the one thing that keeps coming up over and over is how inevitable and inexorable it felt to everyone that was involved, right? It's like this boulder, and it is rolling down the hill, and it is just crushing everyone. And everyone feels powerless, right? To stop it. Everybody on the ground is just feeling like, they're being asked to do these things, or they're having these things thrust upon them. They had no choice in the matter. And if we just stick our heads in the sand and refuse to talk about it, it's going to happen again. That boulder is going to keep rolling and keep crushing us. And so guns and tanks and explosions are really cool, right? And people are going to make games about them, but they're not going to they're not going to make games about the human cost or the decades of repercussions that happen from something like this. If we don't, you know, if somebody doesn't at least try, right, we're going to chip away at that boulder. We're a tiny team. We're 20 people.
Yeah.
Right. We have, this team is smaller than a Halo multiplayer map team. Right. And this is an ambitious project. And I hope this is like the first of, I hope more teams jump into doing things like this, because I feel like it's time for the game industry to grow up.
You know, Peter, that's actually a perfect follow-up for you. You know, I have the luxury here of being able to follow up a couple of other interviews you've done. And in one of those, you'd said on the subject of including the stories and even some missions of, you know, gameplay content of Iraqis in this game. You said, because there's apparently it's a pretty, there's not too much of it. It's a little bit here and there in the game, but you said, very few people are curious what it's like to be an Iraqi civilian. Nobody's going to play that game, but people are curious what it's like to be in combat. So, I mean, it sounds like you guys, I almost feel like there's not a, I don't mean contradictory in the quite combative sense, but it sounds like from what Jamie's saying that there is interesting gameplay to be had there, but yet it sounds like it's a very small piece of the game.
I think that people are not broadly speaking, right? I'm talking about reaching millions of people here, that it'd be very difficult to try to create a Iraqi civilian simulator, for example, and attract millions of people to that experience. But when people are participating in this experience as a tactical military game, we can unveil for them the Iraqi civilian experience as part of that, making that experience and making the player want to understand more about what is happening within the context of the battle, what the civilians are seeing. That's not something they're going to necessarily, it's not something that you and I are typically thinking about, typical consumers thinking about just on an average day, thinking about how am I going to, you know, that's not an experience. I'm like, I want to do that, right? But I can make that experience interesting to you within the context of a tactical military game and make you curious then about being an Iraqi civilian and what was it actually like to be in the city during the battle as somebody without a weapon.
And Ryan, we have to be very careful, right? We're a bunch of guys in Seattle, guys and girls in Seattle.
Yeah.
We have to be really careful in speaking for people that have gone through things that are outside of our experience, right? And so I'm much more interested in letting these people speak for themselves and including those testimonials as well. But we have to be very careful that we're not becoming exploitative or look, nobody's ever done anything like this before. And we are on completely undiscovered ground right now. And so we are trying to carefully and humbly like figure out, you know, kind of where the lines ought to be drawn. You know, I think that I'm very proud of the team for like they approach each of these topics with a seriousness that I think is appropriate for the subject matter.
Well, I think a fair follow up here, because I hear what you guys are saying, but you know, Peter, you guys talk about wanting to make this a video game documentary, and it's like I find that fascinating on the surface, but then you're also talking about, okay, well, we've just got a little bit of the Iraqi citizen stuff in the game itself here, because speaking for, you know, mass market appeal, you've got to lean on the soldier, the combat side. So, I mean, a documentary's job is to sort of objectively examine something. So how do you balance the need, the desire to make a video game documentary about this versus the commercial reality of trying to sell a game to, you know, keep everybody employed and have it be a profitable enterprise.
Yeah, I think people will experience that. They'll get more of an understanding of the Iraqi story, not just from the stories of that the Iraqis are talking about, but the realities that the player experiences as they have to overcome these challenges in the city, because there are consequences on the people for the things that the player has to do. So it's a comprehensive kind of thing. We have to be careful with the word documentary, though. So documentary is you know, recounting factually how something happened. And I'm careful. I've been careful about how trying not to use that word specifically to say that, because we are documentary in the sense that we are going to allow the people who were there to speak to you directly, right? And they are going to talk about factual events. But then we challenge you to actually experience that story as a participant. And then you are actually creating that part of the story after that, right? So what we can do is we can set the conditions that existed at the beginning of a mission, for example, and require you to complete the same objective. But how you do that is somewhat up to you. So that's why we got to be careful about the word documentary, because it may actually be implied to say that the player is going to follow the exact same path that actually happened. That's not true. Our goal is to make you understand through empathy the choices that that individual had to make and the situations and dilemmas that they were in.
And just to speak to that question of the tension between like the commercial viability,
yeah,
and then
please,
the kind of artistic vision, this game could not have been made 5 years ago. Because in order to hit the fidelity that we need to hit for you to connect with these characters, we would need a team of hundreds of people, right? I think a lot of times when these very large games say that they're not political, it's because they're made by 3,000 people on three continents, all with incredibly like different perspectives and experience and even understandings of what is political. So, you know, of course, like they can't have a single vision, right? There's 25 people working on this game. So I can talk to every single person on the team and say, hey, we're thinking about doing this. And from a variety of different kind of political leanings as well. So, you know, we can make this game without so much of that tension because we're making it with such a small team.
Although at the same point, I mean, Peter, you did say that this game is not a political statement in either way.
Yeah. Well, right. So let's parse that.
Sure.
So yes, of course the game does make political statements, but those statements come from the people who were there. And in the game, you will see real people on the screen directly telling you their story and their perspective. And then you participate in that story as if you were them, right? So that is what is unique about this project.
Jamie, I'm sort of on the design side for you. You mentioned the procedural dynamically generated layouts each time you play. So how is death handled in this? Because, you know, you are using real soldiers. They're real faces. So what happens? What can your squad mates die in this game that are real soldiers? Can you die? Which you seem to suggest yes, but so kind of what happens? How does that work in the context of 6 days in Fallujah?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, we're still working on some of that, right? To figure out exactly what the right tone should be and exactly how we should handle it. I think one of the lines that we've drawn internally is we're never going to recreate the death of a specific person who lost their lives in the battle. So there's there's really well known by people that are into this kind of thing, like events that happened, right? Like taking the Culture Center or Hell House. And you can look up on Wikipedia, like the casualty list for those specific battles, right? And so then if we recreate that event, you know, that's getting into some very difficult territory that would be, I won't say can't be handled well, but we're very wary of trying to do it in our first swing. And so most of these testimonials that we're recreating, once you take control and once we're not like specifically telling the story anymore, it can divert from the testimonial that we're trying to recreate, because you could mess up, you know, something could go wrong.
The segment, so the parts of the game where you are playing as an Iraqi civilian trying to sort of just kind of escape to safety, what did you guys learn from the families that you interviewed, the Iraqi families that you interviewed, that has influenced the design of those aspects of the game?
Well, we are going to try to give you just a tiny little glimpse of what it might have been like, and then allow you to hear these stories from the people that did experience it.
Peter, last question goes your way. Although, Jamie, you're welcome to chime in too if you like, but I guess at the end, the way I want to wrap this up, and I appreciate you guys taking the time for what has been a well over an hour conversation here. What is it that you want players to take away from 6 Days in Fallujah when this game finally releases later on in 2021? What is the game's message? What is it? What is it that you would like the game to say?
I really hope that players will understand both the cost and the complexity of urban combat. You know, Sun Tzu, 2,500 years ago, said, never siege a city, never try to assault a city unless you have exhausted every other option. And that has been the advice that military have tried to follow for a long time. And in fact, before these battles began, before the first battle of Fallujah began, both General Mattis and General Dunford begged the civilian leadership, do not make me assault the city. And the reason for that is because they understood that complexity and that human cost of that action. But we who sit so far removed from this don't understand that. And the farther we get away from these events, the more likely it is that we can let emotions drive policymakers to make choices that can cause enormous sacrifices.
My answers are always stories, right? So when I started in the industry, it was 1997. And the person that gave me my first job at Bungie was Alex Soropian. And Alex got his start years earlier. His very first game was called Operation Desert Storm. So that's two careers in the game industry that have spanned this conflict. It is a forever war, and we are still in it. This is what, the seventh administration that is still in it, and there's no exit. And so I want people to understand what happened in the Battle of Fallujah, because it was the result of decades of events, and it kicked off so much that has shaped the modern world. I think you can't understand what's happening now unless you understand what happened in Fallujah. And so that's really my goal. I am trying to have some kind of journalistic objectivity, right? But it is important to me that people understand this tragedy. I mean, there's no other word for it. so that they can help figure out how it doesn't happen again.
Peter Tamte, Jamie Griesmer, thank you guys very much for taking the time to sit down with me here. The game is 6 days in Fallujah. It'll be out later in 2021. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ryan.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.